those that were the Pharisees that were constantly picking at things, trying to somehow make Jesus look bad, not accepting the fact that he really was the Son of God, the sinless Son of God. They're always trying to point out some fault and error, some sin in him, which really was not possible, but that's what they kept trying to do. I used the title actually from the text when it says he saw a blind man. And of course, the story centers around what he did for that blind man. In verse 1 through 5, we have the man born blind. It tells us a little bit about him. In verse 6 and 7, it tells us how his sight was restored. In verse 8 through 12, we have the reaction to the neighbors around. In verse 13 through 17, the Pharisees' reaction. And then 18 through 23, the Jews' reaction. And I've also given you the next set of notes because it feeds actually right into that. Whether or not we get that far, time will tell. We may. In the introduction, just a short introduction, blindness in Christ's day was actually a very serious thing. You would honestly call it a disaster. And to start out with, there was no Braille. There were no schools for the blind. There was basically nothing a blind person could do. There was no welfare. There was no Social Security disability to live on. And so they really came down to being able to do one thing, and that would be to stand in the synagogues or in the temple area, in the court area, and beg for a living. And so it would not have been uncommon in any community to have blind beggars trying to somehow get people to contribute to their need. So the story centers around that. First of all, the man born blind in chapter 9, verse 1. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man which was blind from his birth. The story is quite plain. The fact the man was born blind, it wasn't something that came on him later in life. That obviously is important to the narrative in particular. Many blind beggars would sit in the temple gates and beg for alms, and sometimes likewise in the synagogue, depending on, of course, where they were meeting, that they would be involved in those particular things. But that was a common sight to walk into the temple or into a synagogue and have a blind man at the gate or at the door begging for his living. However, the interesting thing about this is that it was on the Sabbath day. It does not say that right at the beginning of the text, but a little bit later it does indicate that this transpired on the Sabbath day. Now that is significant because, again, on the Sabbath day is when they would have gathered. The Old Testament law said Sabbath days were a holy convocation, meaning, number one, they were not to be working. Number two, then they also would gather in a place of meeting. If it was not the temple, it would also could have been in synagogues, but on the Sabbath day there would be a gathering. So it was logical if someone was going to beg for a living, he'd need to be where the crowd was. And so on the Sabbath day, this beggar in particular was there begging for gifts from the people. It actually was a forbidden thing to beg on the Sabbath day. However, you could still be there and accept gifts. You just couldn't say anything. That, again, was not something in the law of God. That was something that the Pharisees in their laws had made up. I've heard it stated, and I guess I've read it, but it never sticks in my mind. There actually are dozens of laws that were made up by the Pharisees that were not obviously in the Old Testament. And this is one of them that would have been that they couldn't beg on the Sabbath day. They could be there and accept gifts, but they couldn't ask for them. So we assume that that's what was transpiring here. The young man was sitting there expecting some gifts. So in verse 2, his disciples ask him, saying, "Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" The disciples never thought of healing. I don't know why they would have been so trivial and asking a question, well, what about this man? Why is he blind? Whose fault was it? When they should have maybe suggested to Jesus, you know, you could heal that man. That doesn't seem to be their thoughts in particular. It seems like they were more interested in theological questions. Commonly, that's what young men do when they are in training for the ministry. They come up with all of these interesting questions. I remember in Bible college, there were a certain group of guys that always had to have their coffee, and they'd meet in the cafeteria and drink their coffee, but when they did, they always come up with all of these theological debates they would get into. in particular. And I'm not sure anything ever got resolved, but that was kind of common. And I think that's what you see here with the disciples. They were having these theological debates. After all, they were in training for the ministry, so it was logical that they would come up with these theological questions. All right, this man's blind. Whose fault was it? I think we noticed that there was really a lack of compassion here. They weren't concerned about the fact that the man was blind. They even asked questions much like the Pharisees, and that was the type of thing the Pharisees would have asked. Jesus, however, saw the beggar as a man in need. In verse 1 it says, he saw a man which was blind. I'm glad that Jesus saw me when I was spiritually blind. And that, I think, is the testimony. Jesus saw us when we were spiritually blind and saved us and gave us our spiritual eyes. The question of sin was an age-old question. It was routinely assumed by the Jews that disease was the fault of sin. In other words, if you had a physical problem, it was because you'd sinned. And I don't know as that's an ancient question. That typically comes today. When someone gets sick, then immediately some people think, well, yeah, what have they been doing that God's judging them? I think we need to be careful that we don't get into judgments like that. If God is chastening someone, let God take care of that, and you don't have to make that judgment. But just because someone has a physical problem does not mean they have sinned. Yes, God can use physical things to chasten someone, but that doesn't mean that every time someone is sick that that means God is chastening them. There's something in our human nature that we just always got to blame somebody else for something, and that is kind of the sin nature. My wife and I every once in a while joke about this, but when we were dating, we were at my parents' home for a Sunday get-together. I'm not sure I'd call it a picnic. We all ate together, and the family was there, and when those things usually went on, my wife, the girlfriend then, was with me, and we were out in the yard sitting on a blanket, and my little niece, Joy, came along, and she was chatting with us, and we were teasing her like usual. And my mother's flower bed was right there, and she bumped a tulip and knocked it off. It broke it off, and she immediately got this guilty look on her face, and she looked at us, and she said, "You did it." You know, we laugh about that, but, you know, that's human nature. When something goes wrong, we have to find somebody to blame. That's wrong. Don't develop a habit like that. But that was true in the case here. They were trying to come up, all right, this man's blind. Who was it? Whose fault was it? The truth of it was, it really wasn't his fault. It wasn't his parents' fault. It was simply a matter of God's sovereign choosing. But that was where the situation was going. Whose fault was it? Did this man sin? That was the question. No, he could not have sinned because he was born blind. So there's no way he could have sinned. He hadn't even been born previous to this, so there's no way you could say he sinned, that caused his blindness. Then, obviously, then his parents must have been at fault. Did they sin? The Jews even considered that birth defects are caused by a mother looking on sin while expecting. That, again, is one of those type of things that sometimes gets to be old wives' tales, but that was commonly thought, that when a birth defect happened, it was because the lady, while she was expecting, had looked upon a bad situation, and because of that, sin came about, which again is not true. That's what you would call a superstition. I recall my mother was a very godly woman, but sometimes she had picked up some of these little, and I don't know how seriously she took some of them, but some of these little superstitious type things, you know, that people say. And I remember that my sister, who was expecting at the time, she lived in Council Bluffs, 80 miles away, and she had come out to the farm to spend a few days with us, and she was getting quite far along, and we farmed actually with my uncle and his family, which was actually, he was married to my dad's only sister, and we farmed together, and so we were very close. And on this particular occasion, my grandmother Darrow had come out from town. She lived in the little village of Anita. And she had come out and was spending some days with her daughter there, my aunt. And while she was there, she had a heart attack and died. But because my sister was a nurse, they immediately called down to our farm and said, you know, something's happening, get right up here. So my mother and my sister jumped in the car and went right up there. But my mother was always bothered by that because there was a superstition that if someone was pregnant and they were there when someone died, it could cause a defect and cause some problems. Well, my nephew was born, he's perfectly healthy, so that didn't happen. But that's the type of thing that sometimes people get into, and that was true here, that if something was wrong, there's a birth defect, it must be that somehow the mother must have looked upon someone that was committing sin, which we know obviously was not the case, but that's one of those things that sometimes superstition develops. Also, the father was considered responsible until the child was 13. That was also a Jewish tradition, so since he was responsible, the child was blind, it must have been his fault. We're wrong, actually, to seek for such answers, since God actually has not revealed them to us. We don't know why things happen, and that's why it's wrong to try to always find some excuse as to why those things happen. We need to just let God take care of things. In verse 3, Jesus answered, "Neither hath this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him." This man's blindness was actually a means to show God's glory. He was blind because of God's sovereign choosing. That is something that needs to be applied to the situations we go through in life. When something happens like this, be it a physical illness, a death, whatever it might be, don't try to blame someone. Don't blame yourself. Realize that God uses things for His glory. And even in sickness and in death, a lot of times it gives you opportunities to be a real witness. If nothing more, people can see how you handle it, to see that you trust the Lord to guide you through those things in particular and that you don't just fall apart. Or sometimes what God can do through the process of the healing and all of that, that His name can be glorified. And so there's a good lesson to learn from that. It tells us why bad things often happen in our lives. God uses it to bring glory to Himself. And we need to realize that is part of life. That's the answer that Jesus gave. The blindness of the man wasn't because he sinned. His blindness was not because his parents had sinned. None of that was true. It was for the glory of God. Many times, physical problems become a means of showing God's grace and God's mercy in particular. Verse 4, "I must work the works of him that sent me. While it is day, the night cometh when no man can work." I want to take this again a phrase at a time. Jesus said, "I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day." While it is day is actually referring to while I have this short time on earth. He had to do what God sent him to do while he was here. His time, obviously, was limited, as he only had 33 years. "I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day." Which also is a little bit of key of understanding the text. The reason for this man's blindness was so that Jesus could perform a miracle and do his works. That was his purpose. Then he says, "The night cometh when no man can work." In the days before electricity, of course, they had to work when there was daylight. The miracle must take place right then, even if it was the Sabbath day. It was the time when it needed to be done. And it didn't have anything to do with the Sabbath day. It was daytime. It was time when he needed to do this particular job of healing. That's what he came to do. That's why the blind man was there. It was determined in the sovereignty of God to be a testimony for the Messiah, the Christ. Verse 5, "As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." This is actually the second time that Jesus made this particular proclamation. Back in chapter 8 and verse 12, he said, "I am the light of the world." Back in chapter 6, verse 35, he said, "I am the bread of life." And just as we noted last week in chapter 8, verse 58, he says, "Before Abraham was, I am." So again, he uses that expression, "I am the light of the world," which obviously is very significant here because you're talking about a man that was born blind and all he knew was darkness. When Jesus healed him, he gave him light. Jesus said, I am the light of the world. The sight then restored in verse 6. When he had thus spoken, he spat on the ground and made clay of spittle, and he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. Obviously, when you read something like this, we'd have to say, well, that seems maybe a little bit strange, but it was not clay that God made us out of, and God did make us out of clay, but breathed into us the breath of life. Saliva was a supposed cure for eye problems, according to some Jewish customs, but obviously it could not cure blindness. I'm not sure maybe if it cured anything, but that was something evidently that sometimes Jewish people practiced. When they had an eye problem, they would use clay over the eye to somehow cure it. Verse 7, he said unto them, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which is by interpretation sent. He went his way therefore and washed and came seeing. The pool of Siloam was where they poured out a pitcher of water on the Feast of Tabernacles. This pool was used for ceremonial cleansing. And this is actually the pool that was developed as a result of the tunnel that King Hezekiah had dug that brought water into Jerusalem so that they would have water supply whenever they were attacked from the outside and they had to shut the gates and the city was walled up. The tunnel of Hezekiah is still there. I don't know if you can nowadays, but it used to be if you visited Israel, you could walk up through that tunnel. I never did that and really am not interested in doing it, but I had a friend that did do that when we were in Israel the first time when Neil and I were there. Also, usually when you visit Jerusalem, they will show you the place of the Pool of Siloam. It is still there, although they don't use it like they did then. It's basically just one of those archaeological things now. But that's the Pool of Siloam. The pool called Sent actually represents sent from God. Sent is the meaning of the Hebrew word and probably indicates through the tunnel, water was sent into the city. The man obeyed Jesus. He went to the Pool of Siloam. He washed in the pool, and when he washed the clay off his eyes, he could see. It takes the blood of Christ to wash away the sin and remove our spiritual blindness. You can't help but read a story like this and think, you know, the blind man could have said, this is ridiculous. What good is it going to do to go wash that clay off his eyes in the Pool of Siloam? It reminds me of the story of Elisha back in the Old Testament when the foreign king came because he had leprosy and went to Elisha because a little Jewish servant girl had told him there was a guy that could maybe heal him, and he sent him to Elisha. And when he came to Elisha, Elisha told him to go to the River Jordan and dip himself seven times. And the man was angry. He said, well, we've got nicer rivers back in our own land. Why should I go to that dirty old Jordan and wash myself seven times in the Jordan? And his servant said, well, now, wait a minute. What's so difficult about that? He told you to do it. Why don't you try it? So he did. He went and washed himself seven times and was healed of leprosy. And that was the same type of thing. He could have easily said, well, this is ridiculous, and not do it. The blind man could have done the same thing because they know this is crazy. It's ridiculous. Why bother to do that? But he did. He believed Jesus. I think, again, there's a very good application we didn't make in our spiritual lives. There are sometimes situations that God puts us in or sometimes direction he gives us, and you might think to yourself, this is ridiculous. What am I doing here? When God has a purpose. We just need to say, Lord, all right, what's the purpose? Work out what you want me to do. What's the situation supposed to be for? And do what he tells us to do. Now the neighbor's reaction in verse 8. The neighbors therefore, and they which before had seen him that was blind said, is not this he that sat and begged? The neighbors all knew the man. They knew he was blind. So when they saw him, they were absolutely amazed because he was commonly a beggar in a very well-known place. And therefore they recognized him immediately. Verse 9. Some said, this is he. Others said, he is like him. But he said, I am he. Some even refused to believe that he maybe was the blind neighbor, thinking that it was impossible that he could be healed. But the man said, "No, I truly am the guy. I am he. There's no mistake. I'm the blind man, but now I can see." Verse 10. Excuse me, just a moment. Verse 10, "Therefore said they unto him, How were thine eyes opened?" They were curious. What happened? Did you discover some great doctor that could take care of you? Was there some wonderful diet you've discovered that healed your eyes? What happened? How is it that you were blind but now you can see? Verse 11, he answered and said, "A man that is called Jesus made clay, anointed mine eyes, and said unto me, Go to the pool of Siloam and wash. And I went and washed, and I received sight." He rehearsed exactly what had happened. A man named Jesus did it. That would almost indicate that he was not real familiar with Jesus, who he was, and the fact that he had been working miracles. But he outlined it. He said, number one, he took spittle and made clay. He anointed my eyes with that clay. He told me to go wash in the pool of Siloam. The man said that he went and washed, and the man said he received his sight. That's exactly how it happened. Verse 12, then said they unto him, "Where is he?" He said, "I know not." They wanted to know where Jesus was. But the man said, "Actually, I don't know." He did not seek to incriminate Jesus in any way. He honestly didn't know. The Pharisees' reaction. Now, we had the reaction of the neighbors. Now, the Pharisees' reaction, 13. They brought to the Pharisees him that aforetime was blind, and it was the Sabbath day. Trouble there. When Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. The people brought the man to the Pharisees, knowing full well that they would look for reasons to condemn the Lord Jesus Christ. The big issue was that Jesus healed the man on the Sabbath day. The Pharisees had a law that one could not place saliva on the eyes on the Sabbath day. Remember before we talked about they did that because sometimes it helped with some eye problems. However, there really was no biblical law that said that. This was one of the rabbinical laws that had been made up. Verse 15, then again the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. He said unto them, "He put clay on my eyes and I washed and do see." So the simple answer again was given to the Pharisees, the same thing. He made clay, put it in my eyes. He told me to go to the pool of Siloam and wash. I did, now I can see. Pretty simple. Verse 16, therefore said some of the Pharisees, "This man is not of God, because he keepeth not the Sabbath day." Others said, "How can a man that is a sinner do such miracles?" And there was a division among them. So there was a difference of opinion as to how they evaluated what happened. The Pharisees were immediately divided. Of course, some said Jesus could not be of God since he healed on the Sabbath day. If he did that, this can't be of God. Others, however, reasoned that he couldn't be a sinner. They were saying that he was a sinner. He was wicked because he healed on the Sabbath day. And others said, "Now, wait a minute. He couldn't heal someone if he was wicked, if he was a sinner. That doesn't go together." So they were divided even how they evaluated it. Verse 17, they say unto the blind man again, "What sayest thou of him that he had opened thine eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." Then, of course, they put the blind man on the spot. Who did he think Jesus was? He was really not free to say he's the Messiah. If you notice verse 22 for a moment, "These words spake his parents because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was Christ or the Messiah, he should be put out of the synagogue." So he obviously was aware of that, and if he come out and said, "All right, this really is the Messiah, it has to be," he could be put out of the synagogue. But he did confess, but whoever could do this, obviously, he at least must be a prophet. You can't deny that. The Jews' reaction in verse 18, "But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him that had received his sight." Many of the common people just would not believe that this man actually had been healed. In other words, they said, "Wow, that's somebody else. It certainly can't be the man that was born blind." fact, they went so far as to actually bring his parents in to testify that this really was their son. And now his sight had been restored. That's how far they questioned. Verse 19, they asked them, saying, "Is this your son, who ye say was born blind? How then doth he now see?" They even doubted the parents. Is this your son? Was he born blind? How could they explain that now that he could see? What was their explanation? They evidently hoped to learn that the man really never was blind. Verse 20, his parents answered them and said, "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind." That was very evident. They confirmed that. Yes, this is our son. Yes, he has been blind since he was born. Verse 21, "But by what means he now seeth, we know not. Or who hath opened his eyes, we know not. He is of age. Ask him, and he shall speak for himself." How his sight was restored, they did not know. Who had opened his eyes, they didn't know. They evidently weren't there when it happened. Their defense was, "Ask him. He's of age. He can answer for himself." Verse 22, "These words spake his parents because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was Christ of the Messiah, he should be put out of the synagogue." So the parents were cautious with their answers because they knew there was a plot actually to kill Jesus. It was a common knowledge that if anyone openly declared Jesus to be the Messiah, they could be put out of the synagogue, not according to God's law, but again according to their rabbinical laws. Therefore, they feared to give credit to Jesus. Verse 23, "Therefore said his parents, he is of age, ask him." Once again, they referred the Pharisees to their son who was of age. A brief conclusion, the disciples had asked Jesus whose fault it was that the man was born blind. Jesus declared that it was not his fault. It was not his parents' fault. It was for a work of God to glorify God. Jesus declared then, "I am the light of the world." To prove that to be true, he healed the blind man on the Sabbath day. This action, of course, upset the religious leaders very much. They continued to look for reasons to kill Jesus. Moving right on, because the context continues into the next section. Entitled this one, "Where I, as I was blind, I now see." I'm picking up at verse 24, "From blindness to seeing." Then again, called they the man that was blind and said unto him, "Give God the praise. We know that this man is a sinner." The healed blind man was again called upon by the Pharisees, and they demanded, "Give God the praise." They wanted the blind man to say this was all a hoax. They wanted him to say, "God healed him. This Jesus had nothing to do with it." Then they said, "We know that this man is a sinner." They were convinced that Jesus was evil and a sinful fake. They wanted the blind man to prove that Jesus was a fake. And I suppose the real issue was, because he had healed on the Sabbath day, they concluded that made him a sinner. There's no way then he could have actually healed the man. So they did not accept it. They did not believe it. Verse 25, "He answered and said, whether he be a sinner or no, I know not. One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see." What an answer. The blind man knew very little about Jesus. He said, "I don't know much about him. I can't really vouch for him. I can't argue for him." He could not say whether he was a sinner or not. He said, "I don't know." He said, "I don't know how he lives. I don't know anything about that." The Pharisees' verbal snare actually backfired upon them. Rather than incriminate Jesus, the man, in fact, clearly glorified and verified his divine power. "He did know. Whereas I was blind, now I see." That's a good answer. That didn't give them any ammunition at all. It destroyed all of their arguments. What a testimony. Now, I have to ask a question. Do you have a testimony like that? Can you say, "Yes, at one time I was spiritually blind, but I got saved, now I can see"? That's the greatest testimony anybody could give in life. "Whereas I was blind, now I see." What a testimony. The light of the world is Jesus. There's a hymn that's entitled that, "The Light of the World is Jesus," and it's actually taken that and uses that phrase, "Whereas I was blind, now I can see." I'd sing it for you, but you'd all get up and leave. Verse 26, then said they to him again, what did he do to thee? How opened he thine eyes? They ask him again to repeat the story so that they might find some kind of a loophole in it. Like attorneys thwarted in their cross-examination, the Pharisees could only think to somehow return to the basic interrogation. Verse 27, he answered them, I have told you already, and ye did not hear. Wherefore would ye hear it again? Will ye also be his disciples? He refused to tell it again. He asked them why they kept asking. Then he asked them, do you want to be one of his disciples? Now from reason to faith, verse 28, then they reviled him and said, thou art his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. So as they reviled him, in other words, it is common for the unsaved to curse those who have faith. When scoffers can no longer argue the merits of the message, they return to attacking the messengers. And by way of application, I encourage all of you, when you witness to people and they reject that, that's common. When they reject that, or they say nasty things back to you, or they say, oh, you know, you shouldn't talk about religions and politics, all of that is because they're bothered. They're under conviction. They're saying no to God. They're fighting it. That's common. And that won't change till they get saved. So don't be surprised at that they revile you. That's what they did with the blind man. But he said, thou art his disciple. The man had not made a profession, but they accused him of being a follower of Jesus. Actually, he had not had time to make that kind of a decision. I would assume that he eventually would have been known as one of the disciples or followers of the Lord. That simply does not fill us in on the details there, but they accused him of being a disciple, which this was also new. There's no way he could have been identified as such as that. But they said very arrogantly, we are Moses' disciples. We're not disciples of Jesus. They were following a man. They were not following the Lord. They seemed to be ignorant that Moses prophesied of a prophet to come like unto him, and Jesus was that prophet. Deuteronomy 18:15, the Lord thy God will raise up unto thee a prophet from the midst of thee of thy brethren. Like unto me, unto him ye shall hearken. Or in verse 18, I will raise them up a prophet from among their brethren, like unto thee, and will put my words in his mouth. He shall speak unto them all that I have commanded him. And of course, Jesus was the fulfillment of what Moses prophesied. The blind man believed him. But the Pharisees would not believe that. Oh, we're followers of Moses. If they'd have been followers of Moses, they'd have been followers of Christ. They were wrong. The truth of it was, they were not even followers of Moses, as their own man-made law was more important to them than the actual law itself. In verse 29, we know that God spake unto Moses, as for this fellow we know not from whence he is. They were basically agnostics. They knew about Moses, but knew nothing about Jesus Christ and could care less. They said, we know not from whence he is. They refused to believe, as he taught them, that he came from God. He had told them exactly where he came from, that he had come from God. They were unbelievers.